Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. I am joined today by JC Paredes. I tried to say that like with a cool Spanish accent and it just came out very stupid. But welcome to the show, regardless of my pronunciation.
Dude, I love it. If you're going to go Paredes, then you got to go full, you got to go all in. You got to go Juan Carlos too, right? You can't cherry pick.
Yeah, see, I kind of like, I didn't commit. Like I started to say it, I started to like roll the R and then I like lost my courage halfway and fell off, you know,
we're not going to
retake it though. So you're a Juan Carlos, I'm a Charles. So from one Charles to another, welcome to the show.
No doubt.
Great to see you.
Happy to be here.
So we were talking earlier and I wasn't recording and I said, look, man, are you always in a great mood? Because you got on video and you were smiling big and you just seem like you're always in a great mood. Tell me what you told me then.
Well, first of all, I didn't say this then, but I'm in a good mood because I get to talk to you. Like you're really good at something that I have such a huge interest in. I'm fascinated by behavioral finance and investor psychology. So I'm just happy to be talking to you, not to make your head any bigger, but this is a treat for me, no doubt about it. And then taking a step back, sort of bigger picture, my point to you was like, what do I have to complain about? You know, I've got my health, I've got my family, I have my business, right? Like, I guess I don't have like an angry boss that I have to answer to, right? So like, I don't really have anything to complain about. My wife loves me, so she says. I have a beautiful little girl. You know, and then when you look at the alternative, I mean, my grandparents came from Cuba in the early 1960s. They left everything, you know, not that they were like super wealthy or anything, but they were middle class, happy family in the 1950s, which was an incredible economy, especially in Cuba. So like things were fantastic. And then all of a sudden, practically overnight, they had to pick up and leave and you couldn't bring any money. My grandfather used to always tell me I came with 3 pennies, con 3 kilos. And, not kilos, kilos, which are pennies, not kilos. He probably would have done better if he had all that stuff. But anyway, you know, and then they started from scratch so that their kids and grandchildren could have better opportunities. And that's me. So I went to good schools. I went to college. I had a great internship, started working on Wall Street at 22, you know, started a financial blog in 2010 because I was surrounded by, you know, guys like Phil Perlman and Josh Brown and Howard Lindzen. Like these were all my best friends. I mean, still to this day. And they're like, JC, why don't you have a blog? And I'm like, I don't know why I don't have a blog. So they built one for me and the rest is history. So like I said, you know, what am I going to complain about?
Well, your timing is certainly incredible. And if you're going to meet 3 guys on Wall Street, you did pretty good picking those 3. So, you do have every reason to be optimistic. My mother-in-law came from Norway with $100 and a teddy bear, you know, when she was 6 years old with her single mom. And I think it's so shaped her worldview and her attitude. I love those stories about people, you know, making it big in America, taking that big risk. So we're going to talk about markets today. We're going to talk about taking big risks, personal and otherwise. You are, to me, my friend, the technical analyst's technical analyst. And I want to talk to you a little bit about technical analysis because, of course, I'm a psychologist by education. I had to sort of teach myself about markets. When I first dug in, the stuff that really spoke to me was like Ben Graham stuff, right? It was fundamental value-based approaches, cigar butt investing. This spoke to my soul when I first read it. And I must say, thought of technical analysis as just voodoo nonsense. Now, I have since seen the light. I no longer think that. And I've definitely changed my mind there. But I want to know, when you first encountered, when you first started learning about markets, did TA just speak to you from the jump, the way that value investing spoke to me?
Yes and no. I had to learn the hard way that the other one was silly. you know, right? Like the other one didn't make any sense and just kept losing me money for me to finally get it. But the truth is, like, your experience with technical analysis is the same experience that everybody else has. Like, they think they're, you know, they don't actually know what it is, right? They're making a conclusion and they're judging something without the information, without knowing what technical analysis actually is. It's kind of like Chardonnay. Most people who say they don't like Chardonnay, it's because they don't know what Chardonnay is, right? They think that it's that buttery stuff you get in Napa in California. The furthest thing from that, right? And once you start understanding what really Chardonnay is, it's like, wow, this is the greatest grape ever. And it's kind of like that with technical analysis. And what people don't understand is what a broad spectrum technical analysis is. And I'm not surprised that a guy like yourself is interested in the subject because of your background in academia and psychology and behavioral finance, because that's what technical analysis is. We are analyzing the behavior of the market and therefore market participants, as opposed to the goods and the services in which a particular market deals with. That's what technical analysis is. So now let's continue with that conversation. What do you mean, JC, by the behavior of the market and its participants? Well, prices are driven by supply and demand. There's more demand for an asset than there is supply for that asset. The price is going to go up. If there is more supply for that asset than demand, the price is going to go down. I'm sure there are a zillion reasons that will impact that demand and supply. Every buyer has a reason. Every seller has a reason. They all have their reasons. But as technicians, we don't necessarily believe that knowing what those reasons are is relevant in the identification of market trends. Regardless of asset class, whether we're talking about stocks or interest rates or commodities or Forex markets or the intermarket relationships between them all, which we, of course, analyze as, you know, us as technicians. If you're a financial advisor, if you're managing your own portfolio, you need to decide how much in stocks, how much in bonds. Do commodities play a role? How much Bitcoin should I own? Like, these are all decisions that investors have to make regardless of discipline. So technical analysis really goes a long way in helping identify which trends we want to take part in and which we'd prefer to avoid.
Well, you make a great point. You know, one of the things that I like about technical analysis is that it is forecast free. I mean, it's not the only investing discipline that's forecast free. But, you know, if you look at the last couple of years, if you look at last year, every single big bank and brokerage firm undershot their S&P target in January of 2020. Every single one of them undershot it. Now, if you had told them in January that there would be a global pandemic, they would have undershot it by 30% more, and yet we end the year up 18%. You look at the election of 2016, nobody chooses effectively. Nobody thinks that Donald Trump's going to win. And then when he wins, everyone says, well, that's it for the market. The market's going to crash. And of course, we know that did not happen. So even if you can get your forecast right, you've got to get the outcome of the forecast right. And those things are both extremely hard. And technical analysts like yourself just eschew that whole enterprise altogether, which I think makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't agree more. In fact, you know, there are so many investors have their own issues, which you are obviously an expert at understanding all the issues we have as investors. But sell side analysts have not just those issues, but they have additional problems. All that herding mentality, the career risk. I mean, think about it. If you're one of the three sell side analysts left, and you have a job to come up with a price target for a stock or whatever it is, let's say 20 other analysts or 20 other firms cover that stock and 19 of them have a buy recommendation. And in your infinite wisdom, you believe that it's a short, man, you better be right, right? If you're the one that's not in the herd and you get that wrong, that's a big problem. But if you just jump on the herd and everybody else gets it wrong, then you're okay. So as a sell side analyst, you have to be like, okay, I have a family, I have a wife that doesn't work. And this isn't all of them, but for the purposes of this conversation, let's just assume it is, because that's how they behave as a herd. You know, you've got a wife that doesn't work, couple of kids in private school, one of them needs a new car, you go on fancy vacations, you've got a mortgage, you're used to this lifestyle. Like, are you going to risk all of that because you think this one stock is a short? Are you going to put yourself on the line like that? No. And that's, again, just human nature, right? Of course, you're going to put your family and your lifestyle ahead of this particular decision. No doubt about it. And, you know, and if you don't, it must be very difficult for you to go out on the limb and risk all of that. But there are inherent issues with the sell side, which is fantastic for us as people who analyze the behavior of markets and their participants. You know, fading the sell side is a great, great strategy, particularly when you find stocks where the price targets are nowhere near where the current stock is, and you essentially get like a short squeeze from the sell side. It's fantastic. You know, I highly encourage it.
So you alluded to this earlier. I actually ran a poll on Twitter because everyone thinks that their way of investing is the behavioral way, right? Value investors say that they're the behavioral investors because they're running against the herd. Index investors say that they're behavioral because they're just, they're just going to set it and forget it and own the world and avoid forecasts. Now, market technicians like yourself also lay claim to the title. I want you to make the case here. By the way, the poll was almost evenly distributed between, you know, sort of buy and hold indexing, factor investing, TA, and value investing. But I want you to make the case that folks like you are the ultimate behavioral investor.
Well, you could be a value investor using technical analysis, right? You could be a factor investor using technical analysis. In fact, that's the best way to do those things, right? Is to analyze the market itself and the behavior of the market itself versus any of those goods and services that you think that particular market deals with, right? So I'm not arguing that it's the best. I'm arguing that you can incorporate technical analysis with all that other stuff. And listen, just because I'm a purist technician and that's the value that I'm able to provide portfolio managers and investors all over the world, literally all over the world. That's what I do. And I don't dilute that information with something as trivial as an earnings estimate or as an economic, you know, GDP estimate or unemployment, all of these things that we know for a fact because they tell us that they're going to get revised in the future, right? None of that stuff is of any interest to us. We're purely price. And that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody in the world needs to do what JC does, right? That would just be chaos. I mean, can you imagine that? So the value that we bring in is a lot of like portfolio managers, for example, that obviously use fundamental, I shouldn't say obvious, but a lot of portfolio managers use traditional Ben Graham stuff, hence all of their underperformance and everything over the years. But we can then supplement the work that they're doing with our technical and global macro overlay. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you could look at all the unemployment reports you want. Like, I'm not going to do that, but you can. And then you can come to us and supplement that work that you're already doing with what we have. And, you know, the bottom line is that there's no other way of analyzing markets where you can truly weigh all of the evidence. Like, you have investors that are experts in energy, and you have investors that are experts in like technology or marketing or, you know, whatever it is. But because of what we do, we look at stock markets and we analyze trends in every single country in the world. Every single country. If there's a stock market, it's on our list. And in some cases, we have to build our own indexes because they don't exist, right? So we're looking all over the world. We're also incorporating other asset classes. So by the time we decide that we're buying Abbott Labs, 95% of the reason we're buying Abbott Labs has nothing to do with the chart of Abbott Labs. It has to do with, we've analyzed every stock market in the world. And as it turns out, we think stocks go up, right? In that particular example, maybe we like US stocks. Maybe we like large caps and healthcare. And then the best risk versus reward opportunity to express that thesis in the market just so happens to be with Abbott Labs and maybe not Medtronic, that may be a little too far out over its skis or underperforming for whatever it is. And we're just using Abbott Labs to express that thesis, right? That's the top-down approach that you can't do by using other forms of analysis. We don't have to be experts in any one area. I don't know the first thing about uranium. I know nothing about uranium. But if the stocks are breaking out, we can buy uranium stocks. I know very little about the banking business and stuff like that. If they're breaking down to new lows, we could just short them. I don't need to be an expert, or in most cases, people pretend to be experts or they convince themselves that they're experts, which is way worse. We just know right off the bat that we don't know anything. I don't know anything about like Peloton internet sales. Like, I don't know anything. And it was the biggest winner for us last year. I know nothing. I don't like exercise bikes. You know, I know nothing about that stuff. And it was our biggest winner.
So
I don't know if you saw this video. There was a couple on, I believe it was TikTok, and they were talking about how much money they had made in the stock market. And they say, you know, here's our strategy. We buy the stocks that are going up and we sell the stocks that are going down. And it got like millions and millions of views because everyone was roasting them. But then I was also kind of like, you know, on the one hand, they present it as kind of ridiculous. But on the other hand, I'm like, well, that's a strategy with like a 200 year, you know, highly detailed backtest that works. Yeah. So you're a huge proponent of watching price action first, last, and always. Why is this the ultimate indicator? And how can you feel so certain about buying something where you know nothing about the fundamentals, you know nothing about the business or the commodity or whatever it is? Why is it that price is the ultimate for you?
Well, first of all, most people don't know anything about the investments that they're in. They convince themselves to, but they were already going to buy the stock anyway. And then they went and did the homework just to justify that they put in that legwork, right?
That is the truth.
Yeah, they don't actually know anything. So we don't have to lie to ourselves. I don't have to like go do research on Peloton and like, you know, exercise equipment sales over decades. Like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm never going to do that. So, and the bottom line is, why is price so important? Because it's the only truth. The only truth, period. There's nothing else, right? A CEO could be lying to you, or he could just be wrong, right? Nothing malicious, just incorrect. Both happen pretty regularly, right? Sell side analysts, again, they could be wrong or falling victim to their own hurting behaviors, which we discussed prior, and they have all sorts of other issues. And again, those are estimates. Those are human estimates. And by the way, most of the data that they're analyzing is wrong also. So it's garbage in, garbage out. These 23, 24-year-old auditors out of school don't know the first thing about what they're doing. Like, I encourage you to get these kids that are auditing these companies and buy them drinks, take them out, get them drunk, get them talking, and they'll lay it all out to you. They're like, yeah, I've been auditing these companies for years. I don't know what I'm doing. So by the time that data gets to the sell side, like, it's incorrect to begin with. So not only is it so hard to do all those things that you just said, right? Forecasting and all that stuff. But if the data that you're looking at is wrong also, like, you have no chance at all. Not to mention all that government data are, again, estimates that we know are going to be revised down the road. So the truth of the matter is that if there is a buyer and a seller that agree to transact at a particular price on a specific date at an exact time, that's never going to change, right? That is fact forever. That is the only truth that we can actually count on. And then what do we also know? We know that market returns don't fall under a normal distribution, right? You could probably speak to that better than I can. In fact, I'm actually curious your thoughts. But the bottom line is, we know that they don't fall under a normal distribution because markets trend. That is a fact. You can go back any chart forever, go back 100 years. Stocks go up for a long time, then they go down for a while, then they go up for a long time, but they trend. And I don't care if you're a fundamental guy, economics, stars and the moon guys, because I got those too. Like, you could be any of those. You can't argue that markets don't trend. You can't argue that. Like, they trend. That's a fact. And that's why technical analysis works. Because all we're doing here is identifying the direction of trends. And since markets trend, technical analysis works very well.
You know, I go back to, you know, like 15 years ago when I was sort of changing careers, going from being a psychologist to working in finance and just sort of, again, involved in this deep self-study about these things. And I remember thinking, you know, reading about all these sort of obvious in retrospect dislocations in the market and thinking that they must get arbitraged away so quickly, that they must disappear so quickly. And in the textbooks, it seems like they do. But one of the things that I've learned about being a real-time market participant is that trends, both positive and negative, can go on for so much longer than seems prudent or seems rational. And so I think even the most fundamentally, you know, minded, dyed-in-the-wool value investor needs to incorporate an element of trend following into their approach, because you can just be so wrong for so long. Even if you're, you know, even if you're proven quote unquote right in the end, being, you know, bad timing is indistinguishable from being wrong. And that's why I've taken to not thinking of TA as voodoo anymore, because there is that strong behavioral component, and price is the only truth in that respect. But, you know, JC, one of the things that we know is that assets with strong momentum also tend to mean revert at times. When they start trending down, they can trend down very quickly, and they can trend down for a long time, just as surely as they've trended up rather quickly. We saw that pretty dramatically in the last month or two with some of the meme stocks, GameStop and AMC and BlackBerry and the others. What sort of risk controls do you have in place, and how do you differentiate sort of an everyday dip from a true sell signal? How do you manage risk with technical analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you manage risk without it. First of all, we'll start there. You know, some of the AMC moves and the BlackBerry moves, I mean, this was 100% technical analysis. These were short squeezes. You know, this is, and this goes back to most people, I would say almost every investor that exists is incorporating technical analysis into their process, whether they know it or not. And most of them don't realize it because they haven't taken the time to analyze it. But anything, any talk about momentum, short squeezes, even acknowledging that the volatility index exists is technical analysis, because that is a price derivative of the S&P 500. All of these things are technical analysis. You want to talk about seasonals, you want to talk about market sentiment, all of that quantitative analysis that you see, all of that is technical, right? All of that falls under the same umbrella where we are analyzing the behavior of the market versus the goods and the services that a particular market deals with, which obviously the volatility index has nothing to do with goods and services. A price derivative of an index, which is the S&P 500, which, by the way, is the greatest momentum strategy ever, because it buys more of the ones doing the best and it kicks out the ones doing the worst, right? So if you want a good momentum strategy, S&P 500, there it is. So if you're an S&P 500 index investor, what you're doing is technical analysis. You're following the momentum. That is a momentum trend following strategy where you're buying more of the best ones and you're kicking out the worst ones. Like, you're a technician if you're buying S&Ps. Right. So again, most people don't realize that they are, you know, everyday practicing technicians. Now, with respect to risk management, it's a weight of the evidence thing. Now, anything can happen in one stock or two stocks, but in terms of a collective global equity sell off, you know, there's always warning signals. There's deterioration in breadth and waning momentum and expansions in bearish participation, where you're getting spikes in the new 6-month low list and the new 3-month low list. Like, for example, the crash that started a year ago, that was the most telegraphed stock market crash in the history of global markets. There was more evidence to sell stocks and instead buy bonds than any other market crash in history. Regional banks had already peaked in December, right? Transports were making new decade relative lows. The value line index was nowhere to be found. Divergences everywhere, small caps, mid caps, micro caps. Market breadth across the board had been deteriorating. The percentage of stocks showing bullish momentum was deteriorating. So, you know, if you missed that crash a year ago and you didn't profit from it, or worse, you actually lost money during that crash, I think you really need to reevaluate how you look at markets, because there's never been a crash as telegraphed as that one.
I got to give you props. You really did call that in real time. I remember, I think, maybe I'm getting this wrong, I believe it was late January where you started to sort of raise warning flags and say very explicitly what you just said. It's not often that people could call these things correctly, but you certainly did.
And I get credit, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Daniel. But I get credit for that. And same thing in fourth quarter of 2018, you know, we called that one pretty well too, for basically the same reasons. And I get credit for those, even from the biggest hedge fund. I mean, we're talking about serious hedge fund managers that are clients of mine, and we're drinking beers, and they always bring those up, right? They cherry pick those. where I get no credit, and I'm fine, I don't need the credit, like I'm a big boy, like it's not about that, but it's more about a behavioral psychology thing, which is what this conversation is about, is how investors think. They're like, JC, those two calls, you nailed those, right? What I don't get credit for is how bullish we had been up until that point, right? Up until late January of 2020, when I kept getting asked every day, JC, when do we sell stocks? When is going to be the top? And I would say, well, when we see breadth deteriorating, when we see flight into defensive assets like consumer staples and bonds and gold and stuff like that, which wasn't happening then. When that happens, we'll get bearish. And they would ask, and that was going on for months and months and months and months. And then, you know, the yield curve inverted. That means the stock market crashes tomorrow, JC, right? And I'm like, nope, just go look at the data. Like, do you look at your charts with your eyes closed? Like, just because the yield curve inverted doesn't mean the stock market crashes tomorrow, right? Eventually there's going to be a sell-off according to history. And sure enough, we got it, but it wasn't the very next day. It took 6 months or so. But once again, the bond market was right, as usual.
Okay. I can feel you getting a big ego now. So we got to shift gears real quick, but you were right. You were right about the upside and the downside, but we're going to leave that in the past because you recently wrote a piece called Cupcakes and Pizza Are Delicious. You weren't wrong about that. Both of those things are true. And it was all about realizing when you're wrong. So I want to quote you from the piece. You say, the ones who are the best at admitting they were incorrect in their assessment and doing so the fastest are the ones who make and keep the most money over time. It's really that simple. How do you lose weight, eat less, and work out more? But cupcakes and pizza are delicious. Just like admitting we're wrong is very difficult for us. It's one of the hardest things for human to do. So that's the end of the quote. So I want you to talk about a time when you applied this in your own life. What's something you've been wrong about, and how did you realize it and come to change your mind?
Well, if you go back and you read what I was writing in December of 2019, I was like, beginning of new bull market, we're going so much higher, blah, blah, blah. And a month later, I realized how wrong I was. I mean, right there. I'll give you another one. When we were buying stocks in March, in fact, on March the 10th, we put out what we referred to as the coronavirus index, which were the stocks showing the most amount of positive momentum and relative strength, because there's wisdom in relative strength. The stock market's getting slaughtered and these stocks are pushing up against new highs. Like, something's up there, right? There's institutional accumulation taking place. So we were buying what ended up being nice trades: Zoom, DocuSign, Peloton, Activision, Regeneron, like all of these names that later on it's like, well, duh. But in the depths of the crash, those were not easy things to be buying, right? But the relative strength was already poking its head, and that was information. At the time, we were in the camp that this was a mean reversion, that we were going to get a bounce, right? I didn't know that we'd be making all-time highs shortly thereafter, and we'd be at the beginning of a synchronized global expansion like we may have never seen before. And in my opinion, that we're in the very early innings of, which really pisses people off. You want to piss people off when they tell you that we're in a bubble and the stock market's going to crash, and I tell them that we're just getting going? Boy, does that piss people off. So, you know, I didn't know what it was going to be. It wasn't until June and July that we started getting additional breadth thrusts and additional data that suggested, hey, this isn't a mean reversion. This is something bigger. But you couldn't make that call in March. In fact, we didn't. I thought it was going to be a mean reversion. I really did. And the market proved me wrong. And I'll take you back 4 years earlier in 2016. I don't know how long you've been following me, but in 2015, I was Mr. Gloom and Doom. You know, Deutsche Bank's going to zero. The world's coming to an end, right? I was that guy. And in January of 2016, on January 23rd, if I'm not mistaken, man, if I'm right, that'd be crazy if I have that kind of memory. But anyway, January 23rd, we made a low. And that January 2016, emerging markets bottomed, base metals bottomed, gold miners, I remember, bottomed and started a ripper. And then in February, put in a double bottom, which is when the S&P finally bottomed, the Dow, Europe, Japan. And then we went on from there. I was in the camp, because I was still Mr. Gloom and Doomer from the prior year, that was going to be a mean reversion. And we were long, we were buying stocks, everything was great. Our upside objectives got hit that April. and we sold everything thinking that here comes the rollover. So we're sitting in cash through May, going into June, waiting for that rollover, waiting for that rollover. And I go down to Cabo San Lucas with my wife, my girlfriend at the time, for her birthday. You know, I poisoned myself with cactus juice for a good week or so. I came back to my desk. I started looking through the charts and I'm like, oh my God, we need to buy everything. Right. So I went to Cabo San Lucas thinking I was going to come back and short everything. I got my head right. I came back. I started ripping through the charts and I'm like, oh my God, industrials are breaking out. Technology is breaking out. This is a market we need to be buying. Well ahead of any election, I might add. And then after the election, it really took off from there. But they had already gotten going, which always bothered me when they're like, oh, the Trump rally. I'm like, what Trump rally, bro? Market's been ripping forever, like well before any election.
Yeah, so that's the trick, dear listeners. Go to Cabo San Lucas, drink the cactus juice, get loose for a week, come back and see the world clearly. No, but one of the things I think it occurs to me that, you know, you admit you've been wrong from time to time, but you're never wrong for long, because the thing that you're tying, you know, the thing that you're tied to, price, you're willing to be proven wrong. Like you're even happy to be proven wrong. Whereas I think so many people who take other approaches take it personally, right? You think about some of the high profile shorts different hedge fund managers have put on. It's become a moral crusade, right? Or something that they becomes part of the fiber of their being or who they are. And you're not that way, right? I mean, you're happy for price to prove you wrong, and you don't ever let this thing become who you are at your core.
Yeah. So there's two things there. So first of all, we only participate in markets when there is well-defined risk. So we're more interested. I don't care where you think it goes. I want to know how soon we're going to know when we're wrong. That's what I'm more interested in, right? So it's, you think, oh, Bitcoin, it's going to go to 10,000, 20,000, 100,000, make it a million. What the hell's the difference? I'm more interested in what the market needs to do to prove that thesis to be invalid, right? That's more what I'm interested in. So it's almost like I'm almost like pushing the market to the limits in terms of how quickly can it tell me I'm wrong, because that's the most important thing to me, so that we can then move on to something else and not be sitting there wasting time and opportunity costs in something that's not making us money, or worse, losing us money, or even worse, causing us so much aggravation because we're worried about this loser that we missed a giant elephant walking right past us. Because we're so worried about this garbage that we should have taken a loss on that we still haven't, right? That's just the way humans work. Well, that's number one. So we're looking for that on purpose and just assume we're wrong always. Like for everything we do, we always assume we're wrong, and we want to identify what the market has to do to prove that, yes, in fact, we are wrong, right? And then sometimes, or fortunately, more often than not, what ends up happening is that we are correct in that assessment because we identify trends. And by trading in the direction of the underlying trend, you're increasing your probabilities of success. If you're combining strict risk management with participating in the direction of trends, like that's like a double whammy. And in terms of not allowing an asset to identify who I am, you know, that's more, it might not be common sense to a lot of people, but to me, that's really common sense, because if you tie yourself to a particular asset, now it becomes religion. And you can't have normal conversations with somebody who's part of the religion or the cult. Like when I enter one of these clubhouse rooms of fintech and I start telling people that I don't care whether Bitcoin goes to zero or a million, they're like, whoa, 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 who let this guy in? You know, the gold bugs is another great example. It's like the church of the yellow rock, like what, you know? And then, you know, you've got the Teslas, and before that, back in the day, you kids were too young to remember, but in the old days, if you said anything bad about Apple, you know, 10 years ago, like you got crucified, right? And there'll be another, you know, group like that in the future. And that's always been the case. And that will always be the case, these cults. And then you've got the cult leaders. And if there's an asset in the person's Twitter handle or profile, like, you know, to stay away, like they are part of a religion. You can't have a logical conversation with that person. So it's about identifying who those people are, avoiding them at all costs, and most importantly, not becoming one of them.
It's a great point. When you talk about things like Tesla, gold, Bitcoin, it seems like everyone has decamped either, you know, for or against. Like, you've either got to think it's going to the moon or that it's, you know, magic internet money, and you've got to either love it or hate it. But being agnostic about it is, I think, something that not enough people are doing, and something that's a really wise way to make good decisions about it. So JC, I want to shift gears a bit. You've given us an incredible education about markets, but I want you to tell us how you've built such a business too. You are basically a rock star in India. You've built an incredible online business, a thriving community. Tell us a bit about All Star Charts and the community you've built there, and just what's one or two things that looking back you did right in the building of that business and that community.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Because you've had a front row seat for quite a bit of it, and you know a lot of the players that have influenced me. Well, first of all, I think that there's patience is important. You know, I'm not the first one to say this. You've heard it from others. You know, I made YouTube videos for years and nobody watched until year 7. I wrote blog posts forever and nobody watched until year 10. Or I did. Like, we've all heard those stories, right? Usually from successful people. I wouldn't put myself in a category like some of them, but, you know, we've had some success. And I would argue that, you know, that had to do with patience. You know, I started a blog in 2009 and I was writing almost every day for a lot of years. And I didn't know what I was writing for, who I was writing for. It was more so a selfish endeavor where this allowed me to really put ideas down on paper. It forced me to really think things through. And you know, that just helped me in so many different ways. First of all, you know, from a psychological standpoint, my college buddies, you know, my wife, like, nobody gives a damn about any of that stuff. They don't care about the market. When they do care, that's when you know there's something bubblicious happening, right? They don't care. So having a blog, being on Twitter was really therapeutic for me, still is, obviously, just to put my thoughts down on paper and really force myself to think through things. And and this isn't anything new, right? Like, there are blogs today, but journals have existed for hundreds of years or even thousands of years. Kings, you know, brilliant minds forever have written their ideas down on their own journals and things like that. The fact that we have public forums now to do that is a whole nother thing, but the principle behind that is exactly the same. So I encourage anybody and everybody, whether they publish it for the public to see like I have, or whether you keep it personally, either way, write it down. Put your ideas down on paper, because you can always go back to that and see what you were thinking when, from a portfolio sort of Monday morning quarterback standpoint. You can go back and you could see, oh, you know, I struggled that quarter. You know, my wife got sick. You know, I got in a car accident, you know, whatever it might be, or maybe I got a raise at work and I got a little too reckless. But you can identify what was going on in your life at that particular moment or that quarter or that year when you did poorly or you had success. You can sort of put some pieces together. Maybe that helped my success. I started working out more, or maybe I was sleeping better or whatever it is. And you're not going to really know it in real time always. It's always nice to go back. So that's the first thing I'd say. And what that really allowed me was to build the community that you mentioned before all over the world. Because, you know, I had like this thing where you can see how much traffic you got in a day and what countries. And I'm like, oh my God, there's somebody in New Zealand who read my blog post this morning. Like, that's pretty cool. You know, and this was like 10 years ago. So, you know, you started to see that growth. And then when I started visiting these countries, I got invited to speak in Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong a couple of times, India a bunch of times, Tokyo, Kuala Lumpur, and the Philippines. I mean, the Philippine Stock Exchange in Manila is so cool. They got a speakeasy behind a 7-Eleven downstairs. Like, it's pretty epic. Like, I encourage everyone to go. Dublin, Amsterdam, London, obviously. Where else have I spoken? Athens, believe it or not. I've spoken in all these places, not to mention all over North America, right? Toronto, Vancouver, New York, Chicago, Dallas, Miami. I mean, you know, the usual suspects. But all of these opportunities have been amazing for me, because for me to get up on stage and talk about my charts, like, that's easy. I do it every day. I mean, I could do that. You know, I'm happy to do that. No problem at all. I don't really even need to think much. Where I win is in the beers afterwards. right? Cocktails afterwards, dinner afterwards, you know, the Q&A sessions that we have. That's where I'm winning because I'm able to pick the brains of investors that, you know, culturally couldn't be further away from how I grew up, a Cuban kid in Miami playing baseball. I mean, talk about fitting the profile. Like, that's me. You know, I hated school. I just wanted to get the hell out of school so I can go play baseball because my game didn't start till 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock or whatever. And school just got in the way. Like, I knew what I was interested in. I knew what I wasn't interested in. And now I go to India and these guys are couldn't have grown up any different than me. Tokyo, Philippines, you know, in Europe, they're probably a little more similar to me, maybe a little more soccer or whatnot, but at the end of the day, very different cultures. But you know, this, what stays exactly the same
is it price?
Fear and greed. Fear and the greed that drives price, the emotions, the same flaws you and I have as Americans. They've got it over there.
Ours are just bigger. Our flaws, like everything in America, our overconfidence is just supersized. So, you know, JC, next time you go to Manila, you got to take me because I speak Filipino. So let's make it happen next time you go to the Filipino Stock Exchange. So closing us out today, man, I want to put you through the lightning round. I'll just ask you a couple of questions. You tell us the first thing that comes to your mind. So here we are on Thursday, February 18th. What is an asset class that's widely ignored that you're excited about?
Financials, bank stocks.
Boom. Why do people dismiss price action after hundreds of years of track record proving that it works?
Because, and I'll let you answer this all day long, but it's very simple that people have an ego and analyzing trends and analyzing the market might seem Pollyanna. And this goes back to evolution. And I'd love to really have this conversation with you, but that's really what it comes down to is how you're seen in society. Because if you're just following trends, you don't seem smart, or in your opinion, you don't seem smart to others. And that's more important than making money, is trying to seem smart and trying to make and try to impress others. And when you are bearish, you sound smarter than when you were just bullish and joining an uptrend like everybody else. You sound smarter. And for some people who are very weak in that aspect of life, fall prey to preferring to feel smarter in society than making money and helping your family.
Yeah, right on. People dismiss simplicity. They want the complexity, and bearishness also always does just feel a little bit more sophisticated, even though it's wrong about 80% of the time. All the tech folks are moving to Miami now. What's the best thing about Miami for all of the people who are listening to this who will be moving there next month?
Oh, man. So I grew up in Miami. For those of you who don't know, I know Daniel knows. I left when I was 18. So this was a little over 20 years ago. And I went to college in New York, never went back, spent some time in California. So Miami's changed a lot for the better since I left. The best part of Miami, I'll give you a couple of things. So first of all, there's more neighborhoods to hang out in. When I was growing up, you had the Coconut Grove and you had South Beach, and that was it. And now you've got Wynwood and you've got Mid Beach and Brickell downtown. So you got more areas. So that's great. I would say if you're going to move there, don't live in Brickell, live on the beach. You know, if you're a local and you're going into the mainland to visit friends and stuff like that a lot, then you're probably better off in Brickell because you're already on the mainland and you could work your way west and be at the beach quick. But if you have no reason to go into the mainland and the furthest west you're going to go is Brickell, which is basically the case for most people, live on the beach, live on South Beach, man. Like, come on.
Love it. Okay, last question. You are a wine enthusiast, you're a wine expert. What is your ultimate pairing of wine and food?
So I'm a French wine scholar and I'm a certified sommelier. So, and I'm also a certified Japanese sake advisor. I don't know if you knew that one.
I did not know.
As my wife says, I think you just like taking a lot of tests. My wife said. So I am a wine enthusiast. You know, and being a sommelier, one of the things that we get tested on, one of the things that we study are classic pairings. So wines have their classic food pairings that go with it. So like, for example, a Muscadet from Nantes in the west of France. the classic pairing will be oysters, right? Which is a beautiful, beautiful combination because of the creaminess of the Muscadet, because it's on the lees, going with the oysters. Fantastic pairing. But what really made me fall in love with classic pairings are two things in particular. Champagne and caviar is a great combination with like a potato chip, like a salt, sea salt potato chip with a little bit of creme fraiche and a caviar with champagne, nice Blanc de Blanc, which is 100% Chardonnay, by the way, is beautiful. And then also my favorite dessert wine is a Sauternes from, which is usually a Semillon from the south of Bordeaux, a nice foggy area that develops this mold that's called botrytis, called the noble rot. And it's like this mold that grows around the grape. And that's my favorite dessert wine. And as it turns out, when I found out that the classic pairing was foie gras with Sauternes, I was like, uh-oh, this is for me. So I'm going to go with the Sauternes, the Chateau de Chem with a foie gras, like on a nice buttery toast. And then on the red side, Zinfandel from the Dry Creek Valley and barbecue ribs is pretty freaking awesome too.
So we went from foie gras to caviar to barbecue ribs, a perfect place to end. Thank you, my friend. If people want to find you, they want to learn more about your community, where can they find you online?
Yeah, I'm easy to find. Come to allstarcharts.com, see what we got cooking. You can find me at allstarcharts on Twitter, StockTwits, Instagram, and YouTube.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.